You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming to this really exciting event on the Africa's untapped and expanding business potential and how to harness it. I think there's still a couple of chairs that are opened up here for those in the back, if you'd like to come forward and sit down. So in terms of the flow, we're going to start with a presentation of the highlights from the book on Africa's business revolution and how to succeed in the world's next big growth market by Dr. Asha Leke. And then there'll be a short 1 to 2 minute video, and then we'll then move to a moderated discussion. And I will make sure to have enough time at the end so you can weigh in on the conversation. And courtesy of Asha and his co-authors, there will be complimentary copies of the book at the end of the event that he's going to autograph. And that's going to be at the registration when you checked in, where you checked in. He's going to be seated there and then autograph it for you, your own special copy. All right, so by way of introduction, Dr. Asha Leke is a chairman and a senior partner of McKinsey of the Africa region. He started out in Atlanta in 99, but then in 2002, he decided that he's going to move back to Africa and to help the company expand on the continent. And since then, he's worked in more than over 20 countries. In terms of the specific areas he covered, has been ranged from servicing governments, multinational organizations, private sector institutions across Africa on issues of economic development, tax administration, growth strategies, holistic transformation, and investment decisions. And he's obviously very accomplished, and his various recognitions includes World Economic Forum Young Global Leader. He's also a member of a few advisory councils, including the World Economic Forum's Council on Economic Growth and Social Inclusion, One Africa, the Lagos Business School, and he's also a member of the Reform Steering Committee of President Paul Kagame of Rwanda. It is often said that Asha has two jobs. He has a 9 to 5, like the rest of us, but then he had a 5 to 9 p.m., very generous with his time and devoting it to really important initiatives on the continent. Namely, he co-founded and continues to help initiatives such as the African Leadership Academy and African Leadership Network. You will remember in January when we launched here Foresight Africa, our flagship publication, the theme for the year was leadership, and how we emphasize that development begins and ends with good leadership. So very much, thank you very much, Asha, for this and for really building the continent's next leaders. And Asha has also been characterized as the most sought-after man on business matters in Africa, and you get to hear from him today on why Africa is the next growth market and some strategies to capitalize on the opportunities. And you get all of this for free. Under other circumstances, I cannot guarantee that. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Asha to the podium.
Thanks, cool. For the introduction, hello, everybody. Can I see your attention? At least on the continent, we respond. And, hello, everybody. There we go. I feel more welcome here. So thanks for coming. And for us, you know, this for me is less of a book launch. It's more of a conversation we'd love to have about business in Africa. And it's great to see some people who were with us just a few hours ago at the chamber. But the reason we want to do this is because, you know, when I was thinking thinking about, well, growing up, and many of us sort of spent time in the village, and our grandparents used to tell us all these stories about the continent, and writing this book, and it, you know, was sort of a 2.5 year process, enabled us to start to reflect on these stories, right, and ask ourselves, why don't we write the tale of business in Africa, right? And that's what we wanted to do through the book. And the tale starts with, you know, for us, the global media, and looking at how the global media portrays Africa. And we always had an issue with it, right? Because it tends to be always about, you know, we say three things. It's always about, you know, either conflict or crisis or corruption, right? This is just 1 week. We just looked at the New York Times over a 1 week period to see what stories they wrote about Africa. And they wrote 5 stories, right? There was one that was about Boko Haram, right, in Nigeria. There was one that was about the migrants trying to cross to get to Europe. There were 2 stories on corruption in Angola and in Tunisia, and there was one on violence in the DRC. And those are important stories to be told, because those are some of the realities of the continent. But we think there's a whole different side to the continent that is not told enough. It's a story of Africa being more prosperous, right? This is just GDP on the continent, and you can see over the last 20 years, it's literally tripled. It's over $2 trillion. It's a story of, you know, poverty reducing, right? We've lifted 50 million Africans out of poverty over the last years. It's a story of maternal infant mortality decreasing by over 50%. Infant mortality decrease, and it's a story of improving Africa, being more educated, right? If you look at literacy rates, we're at 65%. For youth literacy rates is 70%. Many countries are over 90%. And so, you know, we wrote this book to recast the story of Africa and talk more about the progress, recognizing some of the challenges, but talk more about the progress of the continent. And that's really why we wrote this book. And to start, we started first talking about or reflecting on and analyzing what are the real trends that are shaping the continent today. And we identified 5, and in good South Africa fashion, we call them the Big 5, right? So we talk about those and then talk about the strategies. The first is the consumer. I think everybody knows about the consumer story. It's been told a lot. You know, young, fast-growing, and urbanizing. And I always say each of these words is actually quite important, right? So it's young. Half of all Africans, as we know, are under the age of 20, which is massive. You think of the growth over the next, if you're a consumer goods company, the growth over the next, you know, 50 years. You know, I always say there are more children born in Nigeria every year than in the whole of Western Europe. So if you're a diaper company, you know, where do you want to be based? It's fast growing. And, you know, today we're about 1.2 billion Africans. 1 out of 6 citizens of the world is African. By 2050, there's going to double to 2.5 billion. So 1 out of 4 citizens will be African. By the turn of the century, it's going to get to 4 billion. 1 out of 3 will be African. So 1/3 of the world would be Africa, and this is in an aging world, right? So again, think of the opportunities. There's some risk that it creates, but think of the opportunities that that creates. And it's urbanizing. The average, Africa is one of the fastest urbanizing region in the world. Every year, 24 million Africans move to cities, 24 million every year. The average GDP per capita in the cities is twice the national average. And I know he spent time with Tidjane Thiam, the Ivorian-born CEO of Credit Suisse, to interview him for the book. He reminded us that, and he saw this trend in Asia when he was a leading Prudential. So when you take population growth and you combine it with growth in disposable income, what you get is an exponential growth in demand. Right? So exponential growth in demand, and that's what we're seeing in Africa today. So that's on the consumer. Second is on industrial revolution, right? This demand and these products that the African consumer needs, somebody has to produce them. And the good news is that more and more of these products are being produced locally. We still have a long way to go, but more and more are being produced locally. It took really a bottom-up exercise to understand how much we actually manufacture on the continent today. It turns out we manufacture $500 billion worth of products every year. About 70% of that is manufactured in-country for local consumption. 10% is manufactured in-country and exported across the rest of Africa, which ties a bit closely with the 12% intra-Africa trade. About 20% is manufactured in-country and exported across for the rest of the world. We project that, this can grow to $1 trillion over the next few years, 75% of which will be to meet local demand, right? Again, the demand you saw on the previous page on the local consumer, right? So, again, huge efforts. That's about tripling the historic growth rate on the manufacturing sector. That's, again, tripling that growth rate. And a lot of both government and private sector players are very actively working at that, right? So we have some people from Ethiopia here, at the Hawassa Industrial Park. There's a ton going on there. Everybody's excited about that. It has helped contribute to manufacturing exports out of Ethiopia increasing 7x over the last 10 years. We have the Tangier Automotive City, and all of these, we highlight them in the book, where Renault on its own is also already producing 300,000 cars, right? And the many more of these special economic zones that are starting to function well on the continent. So, again, quite a bit of progress on that front. Third trend, infrastructure. This is, again, an area where we've lagged the rest of the world, as you know, for a long time, right? Across every asset class you can think of, whether it's energy, whether it's road, whether it's rail, we're lagging. Now, on the flip side, 20, 30 years ago, we used to spend $40 billion on infrastructure in Africa every year, $40 billion. Today, we're spending about $70 to $80 billion a year. It's still short of the $150 billion a year that we project is needed across the continent. But we made some progress. And again, here is where, as the work we do on the continent, you can see governments and the private sector and development partners being very, very serious about addressing this, right? You just take energy, for example. As we know, Africans, 600 million Africans don't have access to electricity today. We take, one company, Mkopa, and we spend quite a bit of time interviewing them, and we highlight them in the book. They've, in the last few years, have been able to connect 600,000 households to electricity, right? And there are many such companies that are starting to exist in Africa using solar home systems and innovative technologies to connect households. So again, the trend is positive. Resources. Africa has always been home to tremendous natural resources. Again, across all the sectors. You take agriculture, for example. And as we know, we have 60% of the unused arable land in the world. Sarah, I'm sure, is going to talk to us about that. But again, what's exciting here is you find companies like Babangona, a startup in Nigeria that works with smallholder farmers. They've worked with 20,000 smallholder farmers in northern Nigeria, by the way. They were able to increase yields, double yields, and increase disposable incomes with these farmers 3.5 times. And their goal is to expand to a million farmers over the next few years, right? Again, another company that we spend time understanding and highlighting. You move to oil and gas. And, we are home to, vast reserves of oil and gas around the world. We spend time with the CEO of ENI. And he talked to us about the Rovuma Basin in Mozambique. That has enough gas to power both Germany, the UK, Italy, and France, for 20 years, right? And, ENI is leading the development. But, what he's excited about is not just doing that to export, but also using the gas for local consumption, right? He reminded us that Africa is home to 15% of the world's population, but only 3 to 4% of the world's energy, right? So, again, a lot going on in that space. You look at mining. And across different commodities, we have the largest reserves in the world, right? Across diamonds, cobalt, gold, manganese, you name it, the largest reserve in the world. So, again, on the resources front, you're seeing a concerted effort of all the different players to come together to help unlock these resources for the benefit of the countries. And then finally, technology. Technology is fundamentally transforming lives on the continent. We saw that first with the mobile phone. Right, and today we have 300 million mobile phone connections in Africa, 40% of which are on smartphones. Right, so you can imagine the power of the internet, how we can leverage the internet. We then saw that transform the financial services sector. Right, many people don't know that today, of all the mobile money accounts in the world, more than half are in Africa. right, allowing it to leapfrog and bring financial services to the unbanked. And you look at Equity Bank, again, we spent a lot of time with James Mwangi and really studying Equity Bank. And, you know, he'll tell you today that 97% of the transactions are outside of a branch. Right? They have 12 million customers today, but 97% of the transactions don't happen in the branch today. Right? So, again, technology is fundamentally transforming the financial services sector. And then all of the sectors, we see it transforming agriculture, we see it transforming health, we see it transforming education, we transforming retail. And we actually project that that if we really harness the power of the internet, that could contribute about $300 billion to Africa by 2025. And that's roughly the size of South Africa, right? So that's the impact the internet could have on the continent. Those are the big five. And so companies came to us and said, okay, fine, you know what, you know, yes, we see these trends, but how do you then translate these trends into building a profitable and sustainable business in Africa? How do you do that? And that's really the reason we wrote this book. That's to really learn how to do it and figure out how we can distill that. And the way we went about it is we started with the over 3,000 projects that McKinsey has done in Africa over the last 20, 30 years. We then built on the report. As many of you, we've published a number of reports in the last 8 years, the Lions of the Move series of reports, some country reports on South Africa, Nigeria. We had some sector reports around technology, around energy. We had a report on women in Africa, how to, you know, harness the power of women on the continent. So we really leveraged all of our learnings from those reports. We studied 20 companies in detail, right, 20 of the winning companies across Africa. We surveyed 1,000 global executives, right, to really understand how they view the continent, what their experience has been and how they view the continent. But for us, actually, more importantly, we then interviewed and spent really in-depth interviews with over 40 business CEOs, senior executives, and development leaders on the continent, right? Everybody from an Aliko Dangote to a Graça Machel, from, you know, Paul Collier at Oxford to a Tony Elumelu. We spent time with Graça Machel. We spent time with, you know, Akin Adesina, the African Development Bank, with his predecessor, Donald Kaburuka. We also wanted to make sure we learned from entrepreneurs, right? So we spent time with Sarah, and you're going to hear from her today about what her experience with Grow Intelligent. Spent time with, you know, Fred Swanaker, with what he's built with Tayo Viosu's building Paga, one of the largest mobile payments companies in Nigeria, and really try to distill everything we learned from them into what it takes to build a winning business on the continent. And from all of that, we found, you know, really four essential practices. But at the heart of it was really this whole notion of doing well by doing good, or really making a difference on the continent. So let me share quickly each of these with you, and then we can engage in a discussion. First is, you know, where do you want to play, right? And here I always say, you know, you can either decide to focus on one country, right, like Paga is in Nigeria, right? You decide to focus on one region, you know, like Modjugi is doing with metal across sort of East and Southern Africa. You can decide to expand across, you know, the continent, like you see an MTN or Saham and Sanlam, a combination of Saham and Sanlam. Or you can decide I want to blanket the entire continent, right? Like Coke said, right? They want to have a Coke anywhere in the world, anywhere you are in Africa. We want to make sure you can access Coke, right? Whatever you decide to do, you know, you need to be very clear on what is your aspiration. You need to be very clear on which countries you want to prioritize. Even though Coke is in all these countries, they clearly prioritized 10 countries. So those are the countries we're going to prioritize and really go deep in. And by the way, in some cases, it's actually not prioritizing countries. We believe it's prioritizing cities, right? Think cities, not countries. You need to be clear on how you're going to achieve scale in these markets, especially if you're going to be in some of the smaller markets. You know, you want to make sure you're a dominant player in those markets. And you need to figure out who you're going to work with, right? And that's what it takes. But at the end of the day, to build, and we studied this quite intensely, if you want to build a really meaningful business in Africa, if you want to build $1 billion or more business in Africa, it's very hard to do that if you're not in either Nigeria, Egypt, or South Africa. Very, very difficult. So that's on where to play. Now, in terms of, you know, how do you then do it? Our book is then full of a number of companies that have innovated, whether it's on the products and services side, whether it's on the business model, right? Done things quite an innovative way. We were actually so blown away by all the innovations we uncovered as we were doing the research for the book. that we wrote an article on 6 innovations from Africa that we believe the world should know about. And we just published that in Harvard Business Review a few weeks ago. I encourage you guys to read it if you're interested in it. And I'll give you an example of Indomie, right? You know, Indomie is, you know, the case, a noodles company. They came out of Asia. They came into Nigeria 30 years ago when Nigerians honestly didn't know what noodles tasted noodles. And they've probably become the most successful consumer goods, consumer brands company in Nigeria, right? And they've done that by innovating across in multiple areas, right? So first on the sales and distribution, they found a way to get to the most remote areas of the country, where they'll start with trucks, and then they'll go into smaller trucks, and then to real barrows, and where that starts, people will go by foot, right? And they really get into most remote areas. It's such a good, again, they're a consumer goods company, right? But they did such a great job of innovating on the sales and distribution that they spun off just the sales and distribution side of the business and sold half of it to Kellogg, the U.S. company, for $450 million 3 years ago, right? And Kellogg, as they were looking to come into the continent, they said, look, you know what? We're not going to go and reinvent sales and distribution of these channels, right? Let's just leverage this distribution channel and put our products on top of it, right? They then did such a good job of innovating on the food manufacturing business itself, right? You know, finding the right taste that will suit the Nigerian palate, that even there, you know, Kellogg got excited and paid another $420 million this year for a piece of the food business, right? So that's an and we've seen so many of these. Equity Bank is another example of these innovative companies. But throughout the book, we were actually quite impressed and amazed by the amount of innovation we're seeing companies do to win on the continent. Third is resilience, right? How do you then build resilience? You know, we tend to be quite positive about the book, and that's a bit the feedback we've gotten. But, you know, we recognize that doing business in Africa is not easy, right? But what we found is that the winning companies have consciously found a way to build resilience in the business model. So we spent a lot of time with Aliko to understand, you know, everybody knows about the Dangote story. We wanted to get really below the surface, you know, what do you do to really be so successful? And he spent quite a bit of time just talking to us about how he built resilience in his business model, right? How he decided to diversify, not just across countries, right? Because we think that's important, but also across services, right? So from sugar and salt to flour, then to cement, now to petrochemicals. Because again, you know, he says none of these sectors would always, you know, be good on the continent. And I remember, you know, one of my clients, the downstream oil and gas company, and they used to tell me, look, we're in 30 countries in Africa. Every year, 5 will blow up, right? We don't know which 5 those will be. But 25 will do well, and we'll do very well, right? And for 40 years, they've done very well. So this whole diversification point is very important. He also, Aliko, thought really hard about what part of the value chain does he need to control, more so than you would, you know, in more developed markets, right? So how much of his raw materials does he actually need to control? It was very clear to him providing power to his plants is critical, right? You can't count on somebody else doing that for you, right? In places like Nigeria, you know, he owns 10,000 trucks, right? Because distributing these products was absolutely critical for him to control the distribution, right? So, you know, he's sitting down, he's like a logistics provider with 10,000 trucks that they need to learn how to, you know, manage. But really think about very carefully which part of your value chain you're going to control. He spends a lot of time thinking about how to engage the different stakeholders, right? And, you know, InterSwitch is another sort of payments company in Nigeria. We interviewed the CEO, Mitchell. And, you know, he told us, and you'll see in the book, he told us about how what keeps him awake at night is not his competitors, is the regulators, right? And how do you make sure you influence them and make sure they do the right things? And, you know, we've seen what has happened in, like, for MTN, for example, in Nigeria, right, with some of the issues they face. So really thinking about how do you influence and have a seat at the table with the key decision makers is hugely important. But above all, what we learned from every single person we talked to on the business model is really what's critical to build resilience is about taking a long-term view. Right, it's about it's 54 countries, you're going to have shocks here and there. But what's important is really to be able to weather the storms and take a long-term view. And our research shows that we studied all these multinationals across the continent, and we found that the ones that perform the best are the ones who've been around the longest and the ones who've been diversified across more countries. Right, that's really what it's taken for these guys, for multinationals to perform across Africa. And then finally, you know, you can't do any of this without the talent. Right, and as my friend Fred Swanick always talks about 6,000 days, right? 6,000 days. In 6,000 days, we will have more citizens of working age than China and India across Africa, right? And so for businesses, it's how do you nurture and develop that talent? And in the book, you'll hear, you know, remarkable stories of very amazing women who are doing exactly that, right? You'll hear from Stella, who's a young 22-year-old Kenyan who worked as an assistant branch manager for Subway in Nairobi. And she's a graduate of Generation, which is a program we started as McKinsey to really place these young graduates into jobs. This program has placed 10,000 young Kenyans in jobs across 180 companies. But we found a number of other such vocational training programs that that are scaling up across the continent. You know, Harambe is one that started in South Africa, also scaling up across the continent. And many companies are realizing that they need to create these programs internally to train the incoming staff. You'll read about Nadia Feta, who is the CEO of Saham Finance. Right, Saham was a small insurer in Morocco, and she really drove the expansion of this business across primarily Francophone Africa, and then the merger with Sanlam that came from South Africa and was expanding north. For that, she won African CEO of the Year last year, the Africa CEO Forum. And when we spent time with her, she told us how she spends a third of her time on developing talent, a whole third of her time. That's what she does, developing talent. She also told us that they have a rule at Saham that the deputy CEO of a local operation cannot become the next country CEO. To become the next country CEO, you have to move to a different country, right? And that's really how they promote professional growth and development within the group, right? You'll hear from Sispumzile, who's the executive director of UN Women and used to be deputy president of South Africa. And again, you know, she spent her time telling us how, you know, she's made it her mission to fight what she calls the broken ladder of women's advancement in business, right? And you know, our research shows that, right? Women account for 40% of middle management across Africa today, but only 5% of CEOs. And we have shown around the world this trend. We also show that in Africa that companies that have more women on the board or on the exco perform up to 20% better than if they didn't, right? So it's very clear. So as a business, if you really want to, you know, leverage your full potential, you have to find a way to make gender diversity a priority for you. So again, as we did all this research, we realized, you know, none of these things are rocket science, right? You say, you know, these four practices are not rocket science. But companies that win, and we studied, you know, real in-depth a number of these, we found do two things. One is they're very diligent in working on all of these 15 practices. They don't get all of them right, but really they get to that granularity. And they're working hard across all of these 15 practices. And the second is that at the center of it, they have an ethos of, you know, they're here in Africa. They're not just here to make money. They're actually here to make a difference, right? They need to make money for the shareholders, but they're here to make a difference. They're here to provide energy or electricity, people who don't have it. They're here to provide, you know, financial services products to the people who need it the most. They're here to provide affordable consumer goods and good quality consumer goods products. And they recognize that if they do that, you know, they will make money, right? And they do, right? And they do it very well. We identified today the 440 companies that have revenues of $1 billion or more in Africa today, up from last time when we did the first analysis, we found 400. We've gone up to 440. And these companies tend to grow faster and are much more profitable on a local currency basis than their global peers on the continent. So, you know, so they do it that well. But what they do is they come at it from a mindset of making a difference. And the reason it works for them is because, you know, they weather the storms. You know, inevitably, it's 54 countries. You're always going to have some of these challenges. And if you have a short-term mindset, you know, after 2 years of losing money, you're going to leave, right? But those who really hang in there and find a way to weather the storm because they know that the prize is bigger than just making money. The prize is actually transforming people's lives on the continent. Those are the ones that are winning. And those are the ones that have been very successful so far. So to conclude, I'll just say, you know, you asked us about this baobab and why we try to use that. Because, you know, for us, the baobab on the continent is really a symbol of a tree of life. And we think of these business baobabs, these large companies on the continent as companies that enliven the communities as well. They provide jobs, they provide tax revenue for governments, they provide innovation, which is much, much needed. And so we think, you know, there's a huge need for having many more of these business baobabs, for having a tree of these business baobabs, and we hope that through this book we're going to contribute to growing that forest. And before we end, I'll just then, I'm supposed to show a video so you can hear the voices of the people who we interviewed. Or maybe we'll do that at the end. I'm not sure where the video is. Oh, there it is.
The opportunity to test and experiment as well, to innovate. Go below the surface of all the negatives you read about the continent, and there's so many positive stories about Africa, positive things happening. You know, I know 20 years ago, cell phone companies thought there was no money in Africa. And of course, that's been proven untrue because they met a real basic need. And people fund the resources, fund the money.
You have an incredibly dynamic business environment where people just, with very little, get going and create value. So if you have that kind of population where you have entrepreneurial people who are skilled, who are willing to engage with the private sector, who are the private sector, whether formal or informal, I think it's an environment that businesses should be in.
I've been in GE for 38 years and in Nairobi for the last 7.5 years. And I think the thing that I'll miss the most is going to be the entrepreneurial, opportunistic, and optimistic nature of the African people. Every day, the next day is going to be a better day than today. And there's just a tremendous focus on the future and on growth and really making things better for everybody. Unless, you know, there's fits and starts as that happens, but fundamentally, that's what's happening in the last 7.5 years.
When you live in and work in a continent like ours, what is important to understand is that it comes with extraordinary challenges which require a responsible approach. We have a responsibility, certainly on this continent, to transform people's lives. But there's nothing that is more satisfying in life than to have a young person come up to you, as I have often had, say, you know, I didn't have anybody to turn to. You send me to school. I have a degree. I have a family. And that's what we've all got to do.
When you're in Africa, you're not just doing business. You're touching lives. You're transforming societies. And you're really creating history. And this is the opportunity that anyone that goes to do business in Africa has today.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Asha, for this really inspiring presentation. I think we started out with the motivation for writing this book and the story about the narrative when it comes to Africa. And I can basically attest that based on some of the study we've also done here at Brookings looking at this issue, there's clearly a media bias when it comes to telling Africa's story. We all know media is... could be inherently biased toward the more negative headline-catching stories. But what we found that is that even in Africa's case, it was even more amplified. And it is consequential, because when you also think about what that means for perception of risks, what that means for how risk is priced, and how much is lost, say, in terms of investment opportunities, etc. So that certainly resonates with some of the work we've done here. Why don't we then turn to the introduction of our panelists. We're fortunate to really have some experts with different angles on this issue that can weigh in on the conversation. So next to me is Sarah Menker. She's an entrepreneur, founder, and CEO of Grow Intelligence. It's a software company she founded in 2014 to provide intelligence on the weather patterns, trade flows, pricing dynamics, and productions to help users with actionable agricultural data to drive higher productivity and greater access to capital. Prior to launching Grow Intelligence, she was vice president at Morgan Stanley's Commodities Group in New York. Among her accomplishments, she's a young global leader for the World Economic Forum. She's a trustee of the Mandela Institute for Development Studies and a member of the Global Agenda Council on Africa at the World Economic Forum, and a fellow of the Africa Leadership Initiative, or Aspen Institute, and she also serves on the boards of Shining for Hopes, giving back a bit to the community. So thanks for coming. And next to Asha is Julia Ulku. She's a senior economist in the Development Economics Vice Presidency of the World Bank. She co-manages the Doing Business Data and Report and leads the research on Doing Business Unit. So prior to joining the World Bank, she was associate professor in development economics at the Global Development Institute of the University of Manchester in the UK. Her research focuses on the effects of innovation, technological transfer, and business regulation on economic growth and productivity. And last but certainly not least is Florrie Leeser. She's president and CEO of the Corporate Council on Africa. She has a lot of expertise and extensive networks on trade and investment in Africa, and a strong track record of working with private sector to translate policy into action. So prior to leading the CCA, she was assistant U.S. Trade Representative for Africa, where, among others, she led the trade and investment policy toward 49 sub-Saharan African countries and oversaw the implementation of AGOA. So if I maybe begin with you, Sarah. So you were in New York, Vice President Morgan Stanley, a good salary, good life, yet you decided the best thing to do was to return to Africa to start a business. Can you walk us through it? And then in terms of the key messages that you've heard from Asha, how does that resonate with you in terms of your own experience?
I now have a good life, but not so good a salary. Started a company, but I think my decision to leave, obviously my job at Morgan Stanley, which was good and I loved it actually, was driven off the fact that I was born and raised in Ethiopia, and I grew up believing I was an African. I was actually, when I went to college, the first day you enter college and you realize there's not another Ethiopian in your class, you create your African identity from that day. And so I really wanted to move back to the continent and give back in some way at some point. And I reached a point in my career where I, had done really well, but I had also needed to make a decision to say, is this what I'm going to continue to do? And that was going to lead me down one path, or do I feel like I'm passionate about something else and I'll figure it out? And I chose the latter. So when I left, there was no business plan. I knew I was passionate about agriculture. I knew I wanted to do something on the continent. And so I just embarked on a journey to, A, figure out what country I'd move to. It didn't have to be Ethiopia, so it ended up being Kenya. And I just did some research and kind of went there and then figured it out. So there was no plan.
Can you help the audience understand a bit better about what your business does and why it was important to be in that space?
Yeah. So we're a software and data analytics company, and what we've really built is an artificial intelligence for understanding global agricultural markets. When I left, the vision for the company was to do this just for Africa. And the reason I did that, and the reason we started that journey was because if you think of Africa as a continent, about 63% of the population is in some way related to agricultural markets. Less than 1% of outstanding bank loans have exposure to agriculture. There's a complete mismatch in capital allocation. And the way that you solve a capital allocation problem is by being able to model risk and understand risk profile. So banks or any type of really risk taker can better allocate capital. And that's what I did at Morgan Stanley. I did it for global energy companies. And I said, you know, we cannot solve the productivity problem until we solve the capital problem. We can't solve the capital problem if we don't know how to assess risk. And so we have to start a company that does that. And that was how it started. But, you know, when you're looking at even building a product for Africa, take something as simple as coffee. You know, you look at, and you want to understand Ethiopian and Ugandan coffee markets. It's impossible to do that without understanding coffee markets in Brazil and Vietnam, without understanding buying patterns from Germany, because Germany is actually buys most East African coffee and green beans and then re-exports exactly those green beans to the rest of Europe. And so are there ways to disintermediate it? And so there's these intricate linkages that just exist inherently across crops, across countries, that it's literally actually impossible to study a single region or a single crop without really thinking about it in that sort of contextualized way.
So were there any time during this journey or process you ask yourself, what have I done? what was those challenges, the main challenge you would say?
Every day. you know, I think there's a couple of challenges, right? One is, like I said, I'm Ethiopian and I still held an Ethiopian passport. And then I moved to Kenya. And the reason I chose Kenya is I had two key criteria for what was important to me at the time. I was self-funding the business, but I knew we would raise capital at some point. So open capital markets was a really important kind of variable. And the second was good technical infrastructure. Again, I didn't know what the product would be or what we'd do, but I knew we'd work with data and I needed good technical infrastructure. Kenya was by far the easiest when you needed those two things as your number, you know, top two criteria. So first step is going and figuring out how to operate in a local environment that you're not from. And then when trying to build an African business, the biggest challenge I had was traveling across Africa with an Ethiopian passport. I can go to Europe, no problem. I have residency in the U.S. But getting in and out of Tanzania every time was like I was calling somebody and begging for some last-minute favor so my visa could be issued on time and I could make it, right? So that was, and Acha's been, you know, really helping with initiatives around access to visas. The second is capital, raising money as a startup that was focused on Africa. Mm-hmm. At the time when we did our first raise, we were not global in our mission or our vision, and we were raising for a product in Africa that nobody had ever built. And so, you know, how you pitch that story, who you go to raise money from, is, I think, it's a really big challenge. I think I was incredibly kind of lucky and prepared in the sense that, A, like I said, I could self-fund for some time. Mm-hmm. And B, I left a career on Wall Street, and so my first points of call were the people I said I quit to. Yeah. They wrote the checks for the company. If I didn't have that, I actually don't know what our trajectory would have actually then become. Yeah. I think we've been lucky because of that sort of thing. But I would say those are two key challenges.
Yeah, wonderful. So it looks like some of the key messages from Asha sort of resonates. Map your strategy. You've looked at it, and Kenya was just the place to be. It will be challenging, and you've been facing challenges. Otherwise, it wouldn't be too rewarding. But it was all worth it.
Yeah.
So then, if I can go to you, Flory, you've also attended the Africa Investment Forum.
Indeed. So you've had a
chance to sort of assess. So as you listen to the strategies that Asha kind of laid out, and as an organization that represents or that works with U.S. corporations, which key messages here quite resonated with you?
So, first of all, just congratulations to Acha and his co-authors for writing this book. I think very timely, kind of given where we are. There are a lot of uncertainties that are kind of out there in terms of U.S.-Africa trade, investment, and relationship sort of more broadly. You know, a good time to be looking at how we change the perceptions that businesses have about Africa. And he didn't write it. He and his colleagues didn't write it about the U.S. But I think that the point in terms of U.S., because Corporate Council on Africa has both U.S. and African companies that are members, and some of the people he interviewed, like Aliko Dangote, are actually on my board. And so I think the first point that I want to make, you know, looking at it from this side, is that the things that we hear about from U.S. companies in doing business in Africa, both the triumphs and the challenges, are the same things that impact African companies. And I think that the important thing is that, and it comes through in many of the messages and themes in the book, is that companies doing business in Africa, whoever they are, African, U.S., Chinese, you know, Brazilian, et cetera, really have to look at the continent through, I think, a lens that allows them to see the tremendous potential of Africa and its current contribution and potential contribution to the global economy, you know, as it becomes a greater part of global value chains a destination for investment that is rapidly increasing. And I think that from the U.S. side, I know one of the things that CCA is very focused on is really trying to highlight the opportunities and to distill the difference between perceptions of Africa and doing business in Africa versus the reality. So in truth, I think that there are probably perceptions of higher risk than there really are. The other thing that annoys me personally, this is me talking, not necessarily CCA, is some perception of risk in Africa that's different than perceptions of risk in other parts of the world, which have been very tough to deal with. You know, the former Soviet Union area, lots of people have told us that that's a very difficult area has been. People who went into China, you know, 30 years ago will tell you how difficult that was. I'm sure there are situations in Latin America, countries in Southeast Asia, which are difficult. I don't know that we should talk about Africa any differently than that. I don't think that's fair or right or accurate. But on the other hand, it is true that what governments do in making it easier to do business, and I know Julia will talk about that, it is critical. And I remember, you know, I love the stories in Acha's book, but I remember many years ago when I was at USTR and took a trip taking a political, we won't name any names, actually in the Bush administration to Rwanda for the first time. And we had a chance to meet with President Kagame. And one of the things that we raised at that time was the doing business score of Rwanda, which at the time was not very good. And I remember just a small room full of people where he said, well, you know, no, this is not something that, you know, we can't deal with here. And within, I want to say, about two years, they went from the ranking that they had, which was in the hundreds somewhere, up to number 32. And so the will of African governments to address, seriously, effectively address the doing business issues is not just beneficial for the local business community, which it should be, but it's also beneficial for those who are investing in Africa, and a lot more of that is happening. And again, the U.S. has its own particular story in terms of Africa. It's different than Europe's, you know, the former colonial relationships. It's different than China's. But U.S. companies are there for some of the very same reasons that others are there now. It's a place of incredible opportunity.
Yeah. So we'll get to the doing business part with Fulia, but if I may follow up with you. Obviously, you know there's a big perception, in fact, if we can say reality, that perhaps U.S. is kind of lagging behind in terms of seizing opportunities on the continent, particularly as you compare, say, to China or, for example, to European, perhaps like you mentioned, maybe for colonial reasons. So I guess the question is, currently, what can we expect from the U.S. administrations, maybe this one, maybe the next one, that needs to be done to help facilitate it? Mm-hmm. And in particular, say, the Build Act that was just passed, which is going to double the resources to OPIC. Do you see that as an opportunity here that's really going to progress U.S.'s engagement on the continent?
I do, but can I distill what I think is a misperception? There are, hundreds and hundreds of U.S. companies that are in Africa. This perception of, like, where are the Americans? And, you know, they're getting their lunch eaten by the Chinese. I actually don't buy that. There are a lot of companies, U.S. companies, that have been there for, 60 years, 80 years, 100 years. And then there are lots of new companies that are there, the Googles and the Ubers. And so perception, American companies are in Africa. Now, reality, could there be a lot more? Absolutely. They still represent only, I think, about 1.4% of our foreign direct investment worldwide. So clearly, a lot more could be done. But I do hope that people understand that there are lots of U.S. businesses that are there. And on the point of what the U.S. administration can do, we at CCA were strong supporters, talking to a lot of people about the Build Act. I think making it easier for U.S. businesses to engage with their African counterparts on the continent in the ways that other companies can do, sort of leveling the playing field, is very important. And again, not just with the Chinese, everybody talks about the Chinese, but there are a lot of companies from lots of countries that are there. So even the Europeans, the way that their development finance institutions work. I just think that the Build Act, doubling the amount of money that OPIC will have, allowing equity loans, and not necessarily tying it to U.S. companies. It'll be a factor, but it won't be the only factor. I think that this is going to help U.S. businesses to engage more effectively on the continent.
Okay. Very good. So then, if I can turn to you, Julia. So Flori touched on doing business environment. So is Africa getting a bad rap on this, or what is the state of play? I know you just work with your colleagues to release not long ago the 2019 edition of Doing Business in Africa. So what is the state of play, and what's been the progress?
Yes, before I go through the findings of Doing Business 2019 on Africa, I would like to congratulate Aka and his co-authors on this incredibly refreshing book. I really enjoyed every page because I have an interest, research interest in Africa, and most of the time I find it hard to find good research studies. What I really liked about the book is that it sets out not only the challenges of Africa in a very realistic way, but it also provides very good and concrete information on the opportunities. I love the phrase that was mentioned in various chapters of the book that's called unmet demand. That's something we don't get to see and read about Africa. There is this, as he pointed out, 50% of African population is below 20, you said, right? It's a very young population, and there is a big demand for all kinds of different products. And therefore, there is a huge opportunity for entrepreneurs. Just one example in the book that I really liked, you know, because I like the anecdotes and the statistics in a specific cases. So in Africa, one outlet, you know, shopping outlet, has 60,000 consumers, whereas in the US, the same number is 400. So this shows that there is a huge opportunity for opening more retail stores. And the book is full of these kinds of examples, which gives you a very good perspective. Coming on to the performance of Africa in doing business, regulatory environment of doing business captured by us through the 11 indicators we use every year. I had a lot of presentations on Africa in different parts of the world, and it's always so incredible for me to talk about Africa because there is always good news. Since 2012, Africa has been the highest reformers every year. And this year, it broke another record in the reforms, with 120 reforms implemented by 44 economies. That's the highest numbers of reform both in Africa and among other regions. So there's also a big increase from the last year, which was 86 reforms performed by 38 economies. This year, we also have 4 African economies in the top 10 improvers in the ease of doing business, Rwanda, Kenya, Togo, and Cote d'Ivoire. Rwanda, as you will know, at least those of you who read the Doing Business reports will know that is the most enthusiastic reformer in the region, and it's also one of the highest reformers in the world. And this year as well, the Rwanda was the second highest reformer in the world, and the highest reformer in the Africa region, with 7 reforms in 7 different indicators measured by us. And Togo and Kenya, Togo had 6 reforms this year, and Kenya and Cote d'Ivoire had 5 reforms. So what are the, among the 11 indicators we measure what are the areas that the region is focusing in the reforms, right? This changes from year to year. This year, we see that the region focused on improving the legal environment in enforcing contracts. So 27 economies implemented reforms to improve the regulatory environment to shorten the or make it more efficient to resolve the commercial dispute. This was mainly the result of the introduction of a new law by OHADA economies that introduced the mediation as another tool to resolve the disputes in a much faster fashion. The other area that the region has focused this year in terms of their reforms, 20 economies reformed and starting a business field. And the reforms mainly focused on decreasing the time to register the business through streamlining the procedures and through introducing online platforms to help the consumers to register their businesses in the comfort of their home or easier than just going to the registration. As my colleagues have mentioned, Africa is very big on digital, improving the digital processing of various transactions, and we see every year big improvements in different indicators in terms of electronization and digitization of the processes. So in terms of the overall performance of Africa in the 11 indicators, we see that the region is performing the best in starting a business. Just a moment. And the getting credit indicators. Four of the African economies are in the top 10 globally in getting credit, and these are Kenya, Malawi, Rwanda, and Zambia. And in starting a business, Burundi is 17th in the global ranking. What are the areas that the region has room for improvement? We identified two areas from the regulatory point of view, of course, which are getting electricity and trading across borders. So this resonates very closely with what I have read in Anka's book, infrastructure and improving the trade. You know, these areas are very promising for the region to reap up the benefits in terms of their economic growth and development. For getting electricity, just to give you an idea on where the this is average. Of course, some economies in the region performs better, some worse. But on average, it takes it costs 3,457% of per capita income in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa, to connect to an electricity grid. And the same number at the global average is 1,230% of per capita income. So the governments maybe can focus on improving the cost to connect to the electricity grid. As we know, electricity is one of the most important inputs in production. In terms of trade facilities, the region has been reforming also actively in this field, but there is still a lot of room for improvement. For example, in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, it takes 98 hours to comply with the documents that are required to export and import, and the same number globally is 61 hours. I have, just before I close my comments on the business, I just want to give you a few anecdotes so that make it more concrete. This Doing Business report launched in 2003, and since then, during the last 16 years, we see progress in all regions. You know, the poor performers in the regulatory area are converging slowly with the best performers, and we see a lot of examples of this in Africa as well. For example, in Togo, in 2003, it took 74 days to register a limited liability company. Today, it takes only 5.5 days. I mean, imagine an aspiring young entrepreneur, you know, how much help that will give to that individual and how much it will impact the registered businesses in the economy. There are a lot of research. I mean, there is a lot of research in assessing the impact of doing business regulations on various economic outcomes, but most of these literature focuses on business registry. And they find that making the business registry more efficient improves the formal economy, obviously, also it improves the employment. It creates more jobs. And also, it has an impact on the economic performance. Another example I wanted to give is from Rwanda. Rwanda is the top second economy in the world in registering property next to New Zealand. And in Rwanda, in 2004, it took 370 days to register a simple warehouse with the cadastre. Now it takes only 7 days. So that's a huge saving from the entrepreneur's point of view. In Morocco, in 2005, it took 358 hours to comply with the paying taxes. Now it takes only 155 hours. I have a lot of these kinds of examples. You can read it in the report.
Maybe we'll have a chance to come back a bit in the Q&A portion. But clearly, progress on doing business reforms that have been sustained, for the past at least a decade and a half, and it looks promising for the region.
Absolutely.
Okay, so maybe I can go to Asha before we turn it over to the audience. So the some of the key recommendations you made, as I look at them, some of them may look a bit challenging for small and medium-sized enterprises. We know, as the book also points out, that these are really the innovators and in terms of employment, and we know Africa can use a lot of employment opportunities that tend to make up for anywhere close to around 80%, 77 to 80% of the new jobs that are created. In particular, in terms of managing the risk, so the idea is to focus on the long term and try to ride the short term volatility. If you are an SME, is it really easy to do, or what do you see as challenges that could be really unique to the SME sector, and how should they adjust the strategy in that context?
No, I think it's a fair question. I'd love to hear from people who are actually practicing versus consultants like us who share what we think the answer is. So I think, for SMEs generally, I think, you know, these are what we've seen companies do well, right? But like I said, we've also spent a lot of time in talking to some of the SMEs as we're developing, you know, sort of this guidebook for what it takes to win. There's some things that are, you know, more particular to SMEs. I think challenges around riding out the short wave volatility. You know, if you're a big firm and you can sustain, call it short-term losses for longer, then yes, it is easier. Challenges around financing is definitely a big issue that the SMEs face. Challenges around corruption, even, right, is something that, you know, SMEs face. Probably, you know, more so than large companies. I still think that, you know, the recommendations are the same, you know, across all of these, right? So I think, you know, for an SME, you know, I think critical to really be able to understand who your stakeholders are and who you really need to influence. For me, that's still, you know, very, very, very important. On the short or longer term, I think for an SME, you know, finding a way, and maybe it's a bit harder, but hard finding a way to, you know, minimize the impact of these losses, mm-hmm. call it, you know, in difficult periods, would be important. I think diversification at the right time, right, at the right time, because then that allows you to, you know, diversify your risk across, you know, whether it's products or services or whether it's across countries. So on the other hand, I think the other what you find SMEs are more nimble, right? So it's easier for them sometimes and bigger companies to make quick decisions and adjust or, you know, or change course, you know, based on, you know, some challenges they're facing than you find bigger companies. So I think on one hand, you can argue that it may be a bit harder. On the other hand, I would argue that for some of them, maybe because of the flexibility, it may actually be a bit easier for them to change course. Yeah. I don't know, Sarah. Yeah. But
how does that resonate with you?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the ability to change course faster is definitely a lot easier as a smaller company than as a larger company. I think with regards to, you know, navigating, a lot of countries, for example, have a lot of initiatives around attracting, you know, foreign investment, for example. A lot of those foreign investment bureaus and investment offices are really set up to nurture relationships with large corporates, not with small companies coming to start up, right? So you don't necessarily get the benefit of the incentives that, for example, would exist. Mm-hmm. They exist for you too, but you have to go find them. They're not kind of handed to you on a silver platter, similar to how it would work with much larger companies. Yeah. But the benefits actually exist to both. So it's not one versus the other.
That's actually a good point, critical point to be able to change course.
And then the startup capital issue, I think, I still think it's one of the biggest ones because there's lots of news and media around, you know, African startups and everything else. But at the end of the day, if it's $50,000 at a time, that doesn't scale, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you bring, you know, capital with a lot of kind of money behind, like real capital and plenty of capital behind it, so that, you know, African startups are able to raise much larger rounds, so that, you know, you really become competitive on a global landscape.
Mm-hmm. So. And Julia, in your assessment, that's what you find to be the area where there's been good progress is access to capital. Did I understand that correctly?
Getting credit, yes.
Getting credit, access.
The local level. So we measure two sub-indicators there. One is the credit information, where credit bureaus or registries collect information on the, you know, the history, the transaction of the individuals. For example, do they pay their electricity bills, utility bills on time? To me, I think, you know, this is one of the most important indicators for me, because this is very important for very, very small firms, you know, because they don't have enough credit history or anything, because they don't typically get loans from banks. So they don't have any history, so banks don't give them any money. But actually, they are very responsible and they will pay back. So how do we get information on those people? Credit scores and the credit information helps a lot. There is also a lot of research on this, how having more information on individuals improve the credit access of those individuals.
Cause if I may, because I think I'd actually differentiate access to credit versus startup capital, right? Because you know, I think as you have much more access to credit and, you know, when you're an existing company and you can... But and I think one of the big issues we have with more angel investing or venture capital for startups is that if you look at this market, like at Silicon Valley, I think a lot of what has driven that were actually entrepreneurs who made the money and have now started to reinvest and you know, to promote and to support entrepreneurs, right? And I think we need to have an initiative on the continent to get some of our billionaires to do the same, right? We heard a number of entrepreneurs who actually made a lot of money. And we just don't see enough of them saying, let me take part of it and reinvest to actually start. You know, I think Tony with Illumina is trying to do that with the foundation. That's a different model. And I wonder, is there something where you can, you know, bring all of these, you know, entrepreneurs who've made quite a bit of money together and say, look, you know, let's figure out how you can put a piece of it to help actually provide startup capital for new businesses, right? And create, you know, a virtuous cycle that way that can then mobilize even more capital into that space.
The other thing people don't talk about is what got Silicon Valley to be Silicon Valley, like the first pool of billionaires, is the U.S. government. I mean, a lot of innovation in Silicon Valley was funded through defense contracts that essentially paid for chips, and and the contracts were structured in a way that let failure even happen. So you still, as a company, still made revenue even if you failed, because you still made some innovative milestones. You have no African governments going out and saying, you know what, we're procuring X, Y, or Z, and we actually want African companies to do this, and you get paid for failure. So a huge portion of it initially was subsidized by the U.S. government. And so figuring out the structures that are also created to allow for innovation to happen, where there's startup capital, and then there's essentially cushions and mechanisms to protect the capital of, you know, billionaires that might start these funds, and that sort of balancing mechanism. So, I mean, defense in the U.S. played a huge role in the creation of Silicon Valley that we know today. So,
I was thinking, though, just on another role that the African governments can play that would support more investment and capital formation on the continent is regional integration. And I know we touched on it, but it's so critical, because there's so many small landlocked economies on the continent, and the need to create more markets that provide for economies of scale and for investment in sort of regional value chains, and efforts that can be done so that, you know, Sarah's business in Kenya could be expanded to also, you know, make sure that the entire East African community region gets the benefit of what she and her company are doing more effectively. And so regional integration, the formation of the African Continental Free Trade Area is important for Africa. But frankly, let me just end on this point. For companies, especially U.S. companies looking to invest on the continent, they're not going to invest in 55 countries. You know, it's not going to happen. And so if they can invest in, you know, select economies that are critical throughout the continent, North Africa, Southern Africa, East, et cetera, Central, West, and then basically be able to provide their goods and services to a larger market based on those investments, this is going to be really good for them. So Again, this is one of those things where something that the Africans are doing and have control over and should have control over will benefit Africa, but it will also be beneficial in terms of how it can facilitate and incentivize investment into the continent from other regions. I can only speak to the U.S., but I'm confident that it's true for all the other countries and regions in the world that are looking at the African market today. Yeah,
so basically having regional hubs through which then you
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Very good. Okay, so we're going to now turn to the question and answers portion, as I promised. So if you could raise your hands and identify yourself, I'll ask you, you keep it short so we can get in as many questions as we can, and we'll take three questions at a time. Yes, the lady in front.
Hi, my name is Val Okarubaisant. I'm a professor at CUA. You mentioned, I have a number of questions, but I guess I will just keep it to one or two. You mentioned access to capital in terms of credit and startups. And you also talked about large businesses. I noticed your, Acha?
Yes.
Yes. I noticed your projector, your PowerPoint had mostly large businesses. And I think you mentioned earlier, the moderator mentioned SMEs. But within the context of looking at large businesses, did you look at one, the developmental impact question? Because I know the topic here is Africa's untapped and expanding business potential. And what came to mind as we're thinking untapped, when you're talking untapped, you're also thinking within the context of the issue of startups, you know, in terms of capital. As you know, in terms of factors of production, you have labor, capital, infrastructure. In terms of that dimension of Africa, the human capital, can you please comment on what the impact has been with these companies investing in Africa on the human capital? Because as you know, and then the link to that is also, I think, I'm sorry, your name?
Sarah.
Talked about, within the context of that access to capital in terms of finance, long-term sustainability, what are the challenges of your most businesses, especially SMEs, going beyond just having initial capital and have, you know, being able to sustain themselves in terms of financial viability? And also going back to you, the last one, Acha, you talked about dynamism, you know, the importance of dynamism. I think you and Sarah mentioned that. Within the framework of dynamism, can you comment a little bit about your book, especially talked about Africa as a whole, the importance of looking on a case-by-case basis when you're an investor and you're in Africa, because there's no one-size-fits-all. And how did you apply that within the context of your work, your book? I'm sorry, I haven't read it. Thank you.
It's okay.
But I will.
Yes, the gentleman in the gray suit here.
Yes, I'm Leopold Ekwangale, founding partner of Iago Consulting. I've been an entrepreneur in Africa for over 15 years. So I started also my own business, grew it to a startup, steel distribution, to the construction business, so steel manufacturing. So great story. But what I would like to say is that now I've relocated in the U.S., helping U.S. companies, of course, to expand to Africa. Even though I've been a victim of what we have not been discussing so much here, which is the governance. Because when a U.S. company wants to invest overseas, the first question that's coming up all the time is the risk factor. I understand that for your presentation, you first wanted to, you know, depict the good side of Africa. And I agree on that. There's a lot of potential. But for an investor who is not a big investor like GE, Coca-Cola, these people, these African companies, they know about how to deal with risk. But the small and medium-sized U.S. company, if we want to attract more companies to come to Africa and invest, we need to address and give more information about the risk factor. And the biggest risk factor is not the administrative side, like reducing the number of days for creating a business, is the governance side, the rule of law. How businesses are protected in Africa, what has been improvement in terms of if you have a conflict with a local partner, with a government official, how you're going to be, you know, having your business being expropriated without being not being compensated. So those are the main things that we should be addressing in such a forum to make sure that people understand that there's an improvement in protection or where there's the improvement and how they should be taking the risk to go over there because the investment will be, you know, made safe. The final thing that I want to say is that concerning the media, I understand I would like to defend the media, but the role of the media is not to praise what's going on in Africa. I remember that 30 years ago I was studying in Paris, and the only pictures we used to have in France 30 years ago about China were just people dying of starvation. They were just talking about China, you know, the big starvation, famine going on there. No one was talking about the tremendous transformation that was going on at that time already in China. So to remain fair, we should not be expecting any praise for the international media. Africa should just be working, bringing on changes. And the change concerning the government is a very critical one for the investors because I've been through that. You can have a very good, a bright story of business development and still end up with having problems with local government official. Thank you.
Thank you, Leo.
Hi, I'm actually Rosalind Donald, and I'm probably going to piggyback on what the professor said here a little bit. And my question is for Sarah. How were you able to navigate capital acquisition at the beginning, the infancy stage of your startup? And was it local? Was it foreign? Was it domestic? And how do you continue to generate the revenue, knowing that your company probably needs to innovate some more, to develop more revenue, and to stay sustainable? And
Acha,
does McKinsey inject capital into small startups like that of Sarah, or do you just deal with... No.
That's an easy answer.
They just take on money.
We advise. We'll come back to that.
Right. Or is it just large and medium-sized organizations? And those are my questions.
Okay, we'll turn it to the panelists for this. So this round. Asha, most questions went to you.
Yeah, I'm happy to answer a few. So the professor, on impact on human capital, yes, so we've... So the book didn't focus just on that. Like I said, there's a whole chapter on talent, right? And both on what these companies have done, Bachedon Impact, to actually groom talent that they needed, how they have done to actually source that talent, and what, if you're going to build such a company, you need to do to make sure you can actually identify and grow the talent in Africa. So that's really the focus that we're in the book. We've done a lot more research on job creation, where it's going to come from, that kind of stuff. We're happy to talk about it. But the group was really focused on, if you're going to build a sustainable business, how do you actually source that talent and how do you grow it? On the question of dynamism, I totally agree. We talk about Africa, but it's 54 countries, right? And if you look at our Lions on the Move 1 report that we put out 8 years ago now, at the time, what was happening, growth everywhere you looked, there was growing. So every single country in Africa at the time was growing, positive. And if you look at the 30 economies that account for 97% of Africa's GDP, 25 of those 30s had accelerated the growth relative to the 80s. So there was growth everywhere. So countries were, as a company, were like, you can go anywhere, you'll find growth and you'll do well. Fast forward to two years ago when we put out the Lions of the Move 2 report, what we found that only 13 out of the 30 economies had accelerated the growth. And it was much more nuanced, right? And if you we have a whole matrix you have in the book on growth and stability, and you'll find three groups of countries very, very different. And so then the implication, and for many of our clients, was you have to be much more nuanced. This is just on the country, how you select countries you want to go into, but even on the sector, right? So definitely the dynamism is exciting, but the reality is 54 countries, and you have to be much more discerning there. on the risk, part of the issue is, you know, I think, you know, like I said about the New York Times article, you know, what we hear is always about these guys who had, you know, something expropriated and all, and that's wrong, and governments and shouldn't do that. But what we find were amazing companies like Sarah's and many others who are there building businesses and they're going to scale it, right? And we have a number of these examples, you know, PAGA, we have MCOPPA, we have Jumia that's doing well, we have, you know, the Africa Leadership University, we have, you know, Grow Intelligently, Babangunan. We just found amazing companies who, despite all this risk and the challenges with the rule of law and the challenges with government, with governance and the challenges with funding, are figuring it out, right? And it's not easy, and we don't claim that it's easy, but what we wanted to highlight were actually these companies who are doing it to hopefully encourage others to say these are some challenges, but, you know, you can learn from people who are dealing with it on a day-to-day basis and actually, you know, building something significant, right? So that really was the focus versus, you know, trying to identify the people who are struggling or who've been expropriated, because that turns up in the papers all the time. So we had a bit of a different focus. And I guess just your question, as McKinsey, we actually don't invest, whether it's in big or small companies. We provide advice to companies. They tend to be on the larger end of the scale. But increasingly now we're doing more and more for smaller companies as well.
Take the capital question.
Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of the question around where have we gotten our capital, how much of it is local versus international, it's all international. It's all outside of the continent. And so, you know, our strategy was to basically say we have a vision and we believe that we can build a defensible technology product in Africa. And, you know, opened an office in Nairobi, hired software engineers and took the journey from there. You know, since then, we've been able to raise $30 million. And it's been from investors that range from U.S.-based individual investors to some really large venture capital funds to Israeli and Asian investors. So we really, you know, we've gone everywhere, and you have to find people who are okay with it. We're global as a company now, so we actually have clients around the world. We're not dependent on the African market. And in fact, Africa in terms of sales is the smallest portion of our business now. It's highly diversified, right? And so we're a story of a company that was started in Africa that's become global that people don't even talk about. And then we're a technology company. So it's not easy, but it's very doable. I think we do a terrible job of maybe talking about it. I'm not very good at going out and saying this is what we've done. And it's mostly because there's so much more to build, right? I think in terms of risk of government, we operate an office out of New York and an office out of Nairobi. We're now spending a lot more time mitigating our immigration risk in the U.S. by literally actually moving people to Nairobi on a temporary basis as we deal with all this immigration crap here. So, like, I just have to say, like, we deal with government issues in Nairobi too, but I never thought a day would come where I'm talking to employees and I'm like, hey, this process is delayed just in case. Are you okay with moving to Nairobi for the next 6 to 12 months as we figure it out? And people are okay with that, right? So there's also that, which is we have people sitting in New York where they say, no problem, if my visa doesn't come through, I'll move and relocate to Nairobi and I can go work there and life is okay. So there's, not to say it's easy, but it's not easy here either.
Yeah. You got risk, government risk everywhere. Maybe we have time for just a couple of more questions and then we'll close. Yes, lady in the back.
Hi, my name is Lisa Briggs, and I actually work for the Department of Defense, which is an interesting introduction because the question has nothing to do with defense. I heard in the book presentation that you conducted interviews, which made me feel good, and the anthropologist in me is hearing culture. And so my question to anyone who wants to answer is, where is culture in growth, Africa Growth Initiative, business models, and such?
Thank you. Dave Rabinowitz, I'm retired. And my question really is very similar to the last one in that, you know, there's an old saying, a man with one watch knows what time it is. A man with two watches is not so sure. Similarly, a person who knows one way to live knows how to live. Most of us know how to live, but there's more than one way. And our consumer society, where you're expected 5 days a week to get out, leave your home and family, spend 8 hours doing something you'd rather not do just to survive, is not the only way to live. I mean, when I was living in Africa many years ago, the people around me were living on maybe $100 a year, but they weren't poor. They were living, in Sarah's words, a good life, not so good a salary. And basically, my question is it reasonable to try to export our questionable consumer society to the people of Africa and impose it on them?
Who wants to take the last question?
That side hasn't answered yet.
Maybe it'd be easier if we start with the first question and then we work our way to the second.
I'm not sure that's easier either. On culture, I mean, I'm not sure, I don't know if I'm going to answer directly, but and we're starting to make some of those interviews available online, right? So I'd encourage you to just, you know, go through them. Because, it's back to, you know, and we interviewed them, it was more to understand a bit their experience in building a business in Africa and what really matters. I think the cultural element that came through is, again, for me, is this mindset of all of them were this idea of, you know, we're doing it because it's the right thing to do, right? We're doing it because we want to make a difference on the continent. We're doing it because we want to provide products and services that don't exist today. We're doing it because we want to help improve people's lives. And you heard about what Strive said too. We're not, you know, and we're going to make money there, right? So I think if I contrast that to other regions, it was a very much of a coming at it from you know, a bigger purpose in making a difference on the continent, on the back of which you'll do well, and many of them do very, very well, right? So I mean, that's also on the cultural front that came out of these interviews, was the different way to approach doing business on the continent. On the consumer society, I mean, I think we can all have a debate about, you know, what is the right thing for the continent. We focus on you know, the businesses, right, and what would take for to grow that, and then it means that, you know, we're driving this a bit of this behavior. But you know, I don't think the answer for the Africa, for the continent, is let's try a whole different model at the expense of what exists today, right? You know, maybe it's trying both models, but given in the midst of what exists today, this is a bit what we focused on.
Can I just add just one thing on that too? I just think it's important that Africans decide what they want and what the model is that's right for them, and that people on the outside, you know, I remember when people were marching and saying, you know, no globalization in Africa. I said, did anybody ask the Africans about that? I mean, you know, whether or not they wanted to be left behind or be a part of the global economy. So I would just say that your question is a good one, but I think the answer has to come from the Africans.
Can I add on that?
Yes, certainly.
Consumerism. Yeah. I think the question of consumerism is not region specific, it's global. Mm-hmm. You know, because every individual has instantaneous access to everything. So they demand. When they see that people use iPhone here, they want iPhone too. It's out of our control. So if we need to address the consumerism at the global level, I think, you know.
All right, so with this, we'll... go ahead. Yes, go ahead.
I'm going to give a less diplomatic answer.
Yes, please.
you know, I always worry when I hear statements like that. And the reason I do is that in a desire to battle the maybe ultra-consumer culture that exists in the U.S., the question becomes, should we drive Africans in that direction, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not really an either or, because mm-hmm. to me, it's, you know, when you're dealing with basic economic growth, I mean, it's a debate like in my world, which is food and agriculture. The constant fight I have is with people trying to pitch me that like alternative proteins and, you know, non-meat meat is going to like replace meat consumption. And so Africans should eat meat and less meat and now go into eating, you know, plant-based proteins. And it's there's this, I think there's a struggle, and it's, yes, a good life is good, but we should strive for more. And I think what Acha's maybe in some of the examples he gave is just about what that more is. I think that more and what the construction of more is gets determined by Africans, but we certainly need the $100 a year to go up to $100,000 a year. Why not dream for that? Like, you know, like we should. What that's made up of, we'll figure out later, but we should absolutely not be okay with a content life.
Okay, so with this, we'll go to the, apologize not having had a chance to get to everybody who had a question. So if you get, they will go to the panelists if they have like some quick 30-second to 1 minute closing remarks. And then, and remember, after this, Asha is going to move to the front desk to begin signing autograph copies of the books for you. So, Sarah, any concluding remarks?
I think I made my concluding remarks.
Okay, Flori. Yeah.
I had one thing that I like that Acha said, but maybe one of the few things I might disagree with. Sure. He talked about doing good to do well. And I'm always telling people, at least here in the U.S., that don't get it confused. U.S. companies are not in Africa to do good. They may do good coincidentally while there, but they are in Africa to do well. And so people need to understand that there is a bottom line for many companies, U.S. and otherwise, but I'm just going to speak for U.S. for the moment. And they're there to do well. And the more that they do well, then the greater chance they have to do good. So we flipped it a little bit, you and I. I agree with your point, but I'm just sharing that for a lot of companies, they're not there. That's not their major goal. But we do hope that they will do good things while they're there doing well.
I think my point is only if they don't do good things and only focus on doing well,
they would not do well.
It's not sustainable.
Yes, no. And I agree with that.
Well, Julia, any concluding remarks? Or?
Sure. Two points that overlap between our results and Achal's results is that more investment and reforms in infrastructure and the trade field. I think that's the area where there is a lot of gain for the region. And infrastructure, for obvious reasons, electricity is very important, and the stability and the supply of it is the key for growth. And on trade, you know, obviously Africa has a lot of different regional trade areas, but a trade bloc would really help the region in terms of not only increasing the market, but also diversifying the trade and increasing the value added of the production.
No, for me, I'd say, you know, thanks for coming. I'd say join the conversation, Africa Biz Rev, and let's okay. Continue to grow these baobabs on the continent.
All right, so wonderful. So you've heard it from the most experienced people on business, doing business in Africa. There are tremendous opportunities. They're growing. The business environment obviously continues to be work in progress in Africa like elsewhere. And as you heard from Julia, the continent has also been doing great in that area in terms of progress. But I always like to remind people in development economics the premise that we need to have the best environment, to have first-rate environment, first-rate institutions before the development process can begin, I think has it backward. No country has ever started with the best institutions or the best environment. It's a dynamic process. And it's good to know that Africa is indeed making good progress, although there are clearly areas where they can do more catch-up and then sustain that progress going forward. So thanks a lot for coming and joining the conversation. It was really fascinating. I know there are many other areas we haven't had a chance to get to, like the creative industries. When I heard the issue about culture, the movie industry, the fashion industry, et cetera, or the continental free trade area, what that means for the business opportunities. But we have to save something for next time, right? So stay tuned. And thanks a lot, Asha. Yeah.